Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco, which has been a long time coming. We have been separated, I would say, most of the summer. It's a good thing that we have sort of the means to record while on the go with other people, which is excellent, and due to the support of listeners who have allowed us to have this equipment that makes it so we can do mobile episodes and things like that when we're all not able to get together. But summer is officially winding down a little bit, and we were all able to meet back up down in Orange County where we're usually at. A little different location today. We have air conditioning today thanks to Dr. Rosenblatt, so that's
very
amazing.
Very nice. I need a sweater.
Actually, this might be the first time that we've recorded like a real episode in an air-conditioned room.
I think we tried it once in the San Juan house, but that air conditioner was so loud, I think we had to turn it off.
Yeah, so this is a nice change for us, especially since it's been a really hot summer down here in California. Thank you, fellows. This is part of the 1517 Podcast Network. You can check out all our shows at 1517legacy.com/podcasts. We have 10 shows there right now. A lot of variety. You can even now listen to the blogs from the 1517 site as small audio content. So they're about 5 to 7 minutes each. It's a really fantastic way to get a hold of those if you don't really have time to read it. And I enjoy listening to them more than I enjoy reading them. So, and others might find that true as well. So if you go to the 1517 podcast page there, you'll see the blog cast. You can go listen on our website with the blog, so you can listen while you read along, or you can subscribe to it on your phone and listen to it whenever you would like. Okay, guys, so today we are getting really close to the Here We Still Stand conference, which is cool because last year we did a whole theme of episodes leading up to it, and last year was the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, so it was sort of a big deal. And we did what we called the Reformation Topics mini-series on here, where we basically covered some of the Latin phrases from the Reformation, why they were important, why they were sort of universal to those who were part of the Reformation, Lutherans and non-Lutherans alike, and how they shaped modern theology and things like that. But today I wanted to do something similar, but the topic is different this year. Conference. We're celebrating the Theology of the Cross at the Here We Still Stand conference as part of the 500th anniversary of Luther's Heidelberg Disputation. And a big part of the disputations of Luther's early theology, including Heidelberg, the 95 Theses, and most of what he wrote between 1514 and 1518, has to do with a response to scholastic theology and pretty much direct terms. A lot of the pointed theses there have to deal with that. So I wanted to deal with one of the main phrases that Luther kind of objected within scholastic theology that people may or may not be familiar with. The Latin term is facere quod in se est, and it means to do what is in you. And some people are probably familiar with this, but you may or may not know what this actually means. So I'd like to talk about why Luther opposed this theology and what it means in essence, because you might not really get just from that little phrase there, to do what is in you, what is behind that. So can we unpack that a little bit, just the core meaning of that today, and then talk about why Luther would respond to that in the early Reformation?
Well, it was standard stuff in the medieval church to have this set up. You do what you're able to do with your natural resources left in you after the fall. And it's as if God, if you'll just fall forward 2 or 3 inches from the goal line, think of a football field, he will come 99 yards, you know, and pick you up. Because of that, you did that, and carry you by grace to the other end of the field. But first of all, you had to just first stumble forward a little. But you can do that. You can stumble a few inches, and that was what Luther reacted to.
And of course, he had tried to do what was in him for years,
yeah.
Better than everyone else around him. And kept understanding that he was falling short still.
Yep.
That, you know, if he just needed to come forward a few inches, that he couldn't even do that. And
yep.
That every time he did that, even if he did, right? So even if he did make that few inches, the next time he jumped 10 feet back.
Yep.
You know, and there was
he wasn't making progress.
Yeah, there was no real progress in this, and that's at the end what led him to despair and eventually to what, you know, some have called his evangelical discovery, that it's not about what's in you and what you do or don't do. It's about what Christ has done for you, period.
Yeah, he got to the point where he said, maybe I'm not elect. He was an Augustinian. And he even got to the point of despair of, gosh, maybe I'm not of the elect and none of this is going to work because it was decided beforehand in my case.
So much so that he, at one point, said he hated God.
Yeah. Love God. Sometimes I hate him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is where that ends up, which is where that theology can so often end up.
Yeah.
I mean, if you leave any part of your salvation, right, if you leave any part of the, is it all going to work out in the end, sort of on a, you know, regarding your salvation, to you, you'll understand quite quickly, I think, in most people's case, that it's not going to be okay, mm-hmm. that it's not going to work out in the end, mm-hmm. that if it's left to me, at some point I will drop the ball, at some point I will fumble, at some point I will fail, and probably at more points than we like to admit.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing that it has going for it is the theology of Rome really makes intuitive sense to every one of us. That is, if it's moral at all, it's got to at least be that God will save good people and damn bad ones. That it's what Pieper called the opinio legis.
Yeah.
And it's in every cell of our bodies. You know, if anybody's right, it's got to be Rome.
Right. That's, I mean, at the end of the day, that's, if you read the Heidelberg Disputations, which I think is where you were going with this, Caleb, what I get out of reading Heidelberg is that Luther is really fighting the natural logic of a sinful person.
Yes.
I mean, at every turn in the Heidelberg, he's really sort of waging war against the idea that you could trust your natural inclination on any of these things.
Yeah.
Because your natural inclination will be to trust yourself. Your natural inclination will be to trust your own earthly logic. Your natural inclination will be to rely on your own works. Your natural inclination will be to trust the law for your salvation. This will be your natural inclination, and every single one of them is wrong.
Yeah. I've said to people, if I'm in a debate with a Roman Catholic, say a dentist is there with his wife, it would be perfectly understandable for that dentist to go walking with his wife back to the car afterwards and say, you know, I understood what that priest was getting at, but for the life of me, I don't know what Rosenblatt's point was.
Right. Right. I mean, this is the whole reality of the gospel being an actual stumbling block, right? Mm. If we turn it into something that isn't a stumbling block to the natural way you think about something, it's just not a stumbling block. It's it's easy. It's natural. And that's not how it's described in the text. I mean, Christ doesn't use those exact words, but every time he presents the gospel, even, say, via parables or something like that to his crowds, they end up scratching their heads. They end up going, what the heck is this guy talking about?
Yes.
Like, that makes no sense at all, what he just said. And that's because the idea of such a free and undeserved gift is just not the way the world works. And we have to acknowledge that.
Yep.
When I'm speaking on this all the time, even when I'm doing, say, the prodigal son, I'll say, you know, the reality is that if anything that you hear today is offensive, you've probably heard the gospel. Mm-hmm. And that makes it hard. I mean, even when we tell stories that are sort of gospel-ish stories or stories that point us to the gospel, remind us of the gospel, even if they're from an earthly context, oftentimes they're offensive.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about something that it should not be right. Mm-hmm. You know, it should not be right that an innocent man died for the sins of millions or billions or whatever.
Yeah, and that unjust people, humanly speaking, are going to be in heaven.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of what the Disputations do here is, you know, he deals with why this is wrong on so many levels, why it opposes the gospel, but even why it opposes the law and misuses the law, because you're doing what is in you to what end? Well, to satisfy the law. Well, that means you've misunderstood its purpose, that it wasn't a checklist. It's an accuser, right? Mm-hmm. You misunderstand human nature. Mm-hmm. You misunderstand the problem of sin and your ability to overcome that sin. You don't understand your will. And these things get outlined throughout his work.
And nicely, it was a closed group of his fellow Augustinians. That was his audience.
Well, this is an academic discourse.
Right.
This is two academics having opposing ideas coming together in the correct venue to work it out and trying to figure it out.
Yep.
Yeah.
And in the method of his day, which is a disputation.
Yeah.
And I think this theology is definitely still a part of our lives today in the United States. I mean, hugely.
Oh.
I mean, almost everybody you meet, Lutherans included, will, if you ask them how they're saved, will almost always give you something like this.
Well, I have a question that maybe Adam can help with. I mean, the history and development of this sort of type of doctrine, semi-Pelagianism, really, that doesn't just happen overnight in the church universal or even in the Roman Catholic Church. How do they get to this point? Because I look at this, I guess, from a reformational perspective and look at the text of Scripture and go,
there it is.
I don't know how they're getting this. I mean, you can see some aspects of it, but I don't see how they're getting this as a systematic approach.
The verse I think of, I think it's Romans 11. If by grace, then not by works. If by this, then not by that.
But what's the history of how the church got to this? I mean, because Martin Luther's in it, right? He's mixed up in this.
I mean, you wouldn't be able to find a definite point. Medieval theology, so we're talking 1,000 years of theology.
Yeah.
And one of the things about the medieval church is it's quite, I don't know if comfortable is the right word, but there's a lot of differences of opinion amongst medieval theologians. So one opinion doesn't really prevail until you get to the late Middle Ages. Then there's a sort of a clamping down and trying to define orthodoxy, if you will. But you can find interestingly, though he wrote against Pelagianism, you can kind of find a semi-Pelagianism way back in Augustine.
Yeah.
If you look, let's say you compare some of the nominalist William of Ockham to Thomas Aquinas, they will have different ways of viewing this, doing what is in you. Where it's said, it would take a lot of, I don't know that anybody's done the work, but I imagine it'd be kind of a daunting task. But it said that in Thomas, that little bit you can do, even then Thomas would say God's actually the one behind you doing it. Mm-hmm. Whereas William of Ockham and the late medieval theologians, they believe there's a sort of divine spark within you and that you could do it on your own. So it's really hard to say where does it begin and are they uniform on this view. But when you get to late Middle Ages, so let's say 1300 to 1500, right up to the eve of the Reformation, it's almost unanimous that the semi-Pelagian position.
I guess that's my bigger point is how do we get to this unanimity on it?
Inches, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, things like Lombard sentences maybe where a universal textbook comes around or...
Well, I know the way it literally was said was, God will never deny his grace to those who do that which lies within them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that almost everybody agreed with.
Yeah.
What about to those who do nothing?
Yeah. See, you don't find a lot of that.
Yeah.
You don't find a lot of that.
I guess the reason I ask is because I often wonder how much, and I'm sure that this is impossible to nail down, but how much sort of, because I've been asked this by students, actually.
Sure.
Do control issues on the part of the church have something to do with this, right? That I think there could be a historical case made that after the Reformation, the church sort of loses control, in a sense, of the people and the politics and the whole nine yards. But if you say, right, that you have to make these first moves on your own and that these first moves intrinsically involve the quote-unquote church, you maintain a lot of control over the situation.
You know, it may be true, but as Lewis said, a psychological argument always needs another better one. It can't stand on its own. Yeah. It can't carry the weight. Mm-hmm. It's like Oprah and people who accuse one another of bad motives.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
this is going to go nowhere. You got any facts to back it up? So you may be, that may be right.
Oh, complete conjecture on my part.
Yeah, it may be correct.
So it's just interesting to me because you, in our day, we don't find that, we don't find unanimous opinions like that. We just don't.
Yeah.
I don't, in the Middle Ages, you, I don't know until, it's not until you get to the late Middle Ages where it becomes unanimous.
Yeah.
We tend to think, we take the whole Middle Ages as one epoch.
And it is.
No, it's an absolute mess. And it's, I mean, I think the big pope you could point to as like the height of papal monarchy and the centralization of church authority would be Innocent III. Uh-huh. So late 12th, early 13th century.
Yeah.
It reaches its zenith and then it starts to crumble pretty quickly thereafter. Hmm.
I've told this before, but I'll just make it short. My conversation with mathematician Robert Meyer there on campus years ago, and he looked at me and said, what do you think is the greatest discovery in the 16th century? I said, that a sinner is saved by God's grace sola on account of the death of Christ sola, and by faith in that death of Christ sola. And Robert answered, I used to believe that too. I said, what do you think now? And he said, I think it was a discovery of a real doctrine of sin.
Mm. Well, yeah. And
of course, that plays to what we're talking about. I can't even want to
yeah.
get back toward my creator.
Right.
I'm on the opposite side. I'm a hater of him in Adam.
Yeah, so let's get into that. So if you did what was in you, the result would be sin, not goodness towards the law, right?
Well, and that's what Luther points out in the Disputations for sure. If you go down this path, the result is going to be sin.
Yeah.
You might, and the funny thing is one of the things I think the Disputations are great for is things that you might have previously thought were good, good works, if you know, seen in this light. Which I think is a scriptural light, you'll understand that that's actually a sin.
Yeah.
That you're actually committing deep sin there. And I think, so I'd go, certainly would go along with Dr. Meyer on that. But one of the things that I think happened first in the Reformation that really made things clear, and I think Caleb alluded to it earlier, was a I don't want to say rediscovery, maybe a reconnection with the authentic law of God.
Yeah.
And its intended purpose.
Yeah. To kill.
Yeah, to kill. To point to the sinner eventually to Christ through their utter destruction of their self. And again, that's such a hard thing for us to lay our hands on in our day and age because
it isn't a question to anybody we know.
Well, and the self is such an important thing in our time, you know.
The answer is in the self.
Self-esteem, self-confidence, you know, self-directed life, self this, self that, self the other. And there's this whole doctrine in the scriptures which is dedicated to killing that self. So that that self might be rebuilt really in Christ. And, you know, that's a mind-blowing thing. And obviously it wasn't his time, too.
Right.
It's funny to me that, you know, when Luther or Lutherans and even Lutherans today get criticized, a lot of it is in regards to towards the law or a weakness towards the law in some way, mostly referencing how we approach the Christian life. But Luther used the law very directly, very upfront, constantly. And in Heidelberg, when you're looking at it, it's interesting because he opens the Disputations, the first two theses, with the perfection of the law of God. It is the greatest good in this life, right? That was an opening point of agreement. You could walk in the room to any Catholic, right? And people are going to say that about the law. And I think that it would be an opening point of agreement now. It's just then what the law was actually meant to accomplish is where he's going to diverge from this. It is the most beneficial thing in life because it accuses you and allows you to receive Christ.
I mean, I don't really want to poke at sleeping bears in this episode, but I really don't think that after the second comma in the first Disputation, there'd be a lot of agreement in Lutheranism today, and we've gone in an interesting path. I mean, the first Disputation reads the law of God, comma, the most salutary doctrine of life, comma. I think, you know, most people would be shaking their head at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, absolutely. he goes on to say, cannot advance man on his way to righteousness.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of confusion on that in Lutheranism today. I think there absolutely is. And then if you go after that third comma, I think this gets to be very controversial, but rather hinders him.
Yeah.
I mean, if you walk around in Lutheran circles today and say, you know, the law hinders me on my way to righteousness.
Uh-huh. Oh, just straight mm-hmm. Luther.
You might get sermons preached against you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's a reality. And I think that this is a, obviously the Heidelberg Disputations for those, you know, really hardcore Lutherans that are listening is not a confessional document. You know,
yep.
no one subscribes to it and no one says, in order to preach or teach in the church, no one has to raise their hand and say, you know, I believe this is in total agreement with Scripture. None of that has to happen here. This is an early writing of Luther, which is up for debate, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. But if you believe that, right, if you actually think that that's a scriptural statement to say that the law of God, even though it's the most salutary doctrine of life, cannot advance man on his way to righteousness, but rather hinders him, that puts you in a particular sort of corner these
sure.
days.
Sure.
You know? If you're taking ring analogy,
most would furrow their brows.
Right.
What did you just say? Or what? What was that?
It's funny because, I mean, I don't want to sound snobby, but even the Latin there is actually more dramatic than that older translation
really?
of hinders. It's an active enemy, something that is doing something against him. I've translated it speaking against, accusing, but literally to do harm towards that advancement.
But think about it. Think about what he's, and I think this is where we get stuck on this in our day, that I don't think people sort of think through words a lot. What is he saying there? Well, he's saying if you understand, like you brought up earlier, Caleb, that the law's primary goal is to drive you to, you know, utter despair.
Mm-hmm.
So that the only hope you have left is Christ alone.
Yep.
Right? That obviously if you rely on it for anything else, in other words, if you use it as a checklist to see how you're doing and you say, oh, well, you know, there's 10 of those things on that checklist and I got 8 of them pretty locked up, uh-huh. I'm doing okay. That is obviously going to hinder you to that getting to that point of despair where you rely on Christ alone, yeah. which is your only hope for salvation.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying that, you know, it's not saying what the conclusion today is that, oh, are you then saying that the law hinders you to being a quote unquote better person? I'm like, no, God, no, I wouldn't say that. It's actually, if your goal is to be a better person here in this world, right?
He's saying it can accomplish that in some ways.
Yeah. You, mm-hmm. I guess, yes. Look at the Decalogue to see sort of what the standard is, but
and maybe
just,
a civil well,
that's,
righteous.
That's a civil way. That's yeah, where that's what I mean. In just here, right mm-hmm. now, in the
you'll be elected mayor.
Yeah, but if you are looking at your salvation, mm-hmm. your whether or not you're right before God, all of these things it's not gonna, you know, it's got one thing to do in that area, and that's to convict you of the reality that you're not right before God apart from Christ.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then once you are totally broken down to show you, you know, and to really to resurrect you by means of the proclamation of the gospel and to resurrect you in Christ alone. Mm-hmm. I mean, but if we take it to mean something that he doesn't mean there, you know,
yeah.
in other words, he's not saying, boy, if you really want to know the way to live a crappy life, look at the law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not what he's saying. Isn't that, has nothing to do with that. It has to do with whether or not that word righteous, as he's using it there, has to do with whether or not you can stand blameless before a holy God.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, in one of the later proofs, maybe the proof of two, he talks about how, you know, this is going to be confusing to most people because most people are doing some sort of civil good. Like, you know, most people aren't, you know, raping and pillaging and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. you're being somewhat of a civil person. So this mm-hmm. is going to be confusing to you at first because you're going to say, well, I do some of the law every day.
Well, in fact, when you teach this, like in a basic theology class, to people who haven't thought about it a lot,
it shows up.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, "What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a good person." And you're like,
"Does the doctrine of two kinds of righteousness?" Which
yes,
I'm told it's controversial. I don't know why it would be.
It's the same thing.
Doesn't it help clean that up?
I think it can.
I mean,
I think it's controversial, much like this, because it gets into, you know, weird aberrations on either side. That
but that one is really it's short, and it's really worth reading. Two mm-hmm. kinds of yeah. righteousness.
Well, he calls it the nut of his theology at one point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Luther's little work on it is, I think, very helpful.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I just don't get the controversy or the confusion. Your righteousness before God is completely alien, given to you, imputed to you, declared.
Mm-hmm.
Your righteousness before men mm-hmm. is something you pursue, but it has not. It has no bearing on the vertical.
Well, it's the fact that it has no bearing on the vertical that I think drives people crazy. Okay. I mean, I really do. I think that mm-hmm. even our own pastor sometimes that makes them nuts. That how, you know, your pursuit of righteousness before other men has no bearing on yep. whether or not you are righteous before God. That makes people nuts.
Yep.
Like if I, having taught basic theology classes even to 18-year-olds who aren't thinking about anything, mm-hmm. you walk in a room and you say that, you know, those who aren't on their phones, you know, will...
Yeah,
and think about it for even a half a second. They'll find it offensive. Mm-hmm. It's very offensive.
Yeah,
why wouldn't it have anything to do? Why wouldn't whether right. or not I'm a decent person pursuing being a good guy and a good neighbor mm-hmm. have anything to do with my relationship before God?
Yep.
Seems like it should.
Yep.
Yeah, and if you're
the
not thinking of
a little differently,
what's
Christ
that?
In the Well, I think this is one of the areas where sort of that historical approach we take to the resurrection really helps, because if you don't have that, this is going to be your only sort of visible, verifiable proof of anything happening, is that I've been being good. That's what I can... Mm-hmm. My memory says I've been good. That's what I can rely on.
Sure.
If you take that away from
and
people...
And plus, the way your brain works is you remember everybody that's doing it. Worse job than you at.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah.
And you remember every instance.
Latin quorum minibus.
Right. You know,
as compared with Charlie.
Yeah. You're looking at, you drive down the road down here in Westminster and you'll probably see five people that are, you know, worse at it than you are. And
yeah.
you remember those.
Yeah.
And that's why it's hard. And this gets back to the gospel as a stumbling block. That's why it's hard for us to say that what Luther writes here makes a lot of sense, because if you do, you have to acknowledge that the way you are hardwired to think about things, or, you know, the way that your sinful self thinks about things doesn't make sense, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. And that, mm-hmm. you know, the way that God says that the thing actually works would be really confusing.
Yeah. Now, one of the things here, too, is that this is being a little off. It can throw the whole thing off, right? Because part of what's behind this phrase, as Rod went about, was there is some reliance on God here still, too, right? They're not what we would say
right.
full Pelagians. They're not
right.
saying
right.
we have to do everything in our power to earn
right.
all of our salvation.
Yep, Pelagius was declared a heretic.
Yeah, but just being a little off.
Like most heretics, so he made his way in through the back door still.
That's
yep.
right.
Oh, yeah.
It ruins the whole thing.
Yep.
You can't have a little bit of this left.
Think yeast. Yeast in the scriptures is usually not a good thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think it's a good spot to take our break, so we'll do that, and then we'll come back just to wrap up the ends of this episode. Hello there, and welcome to our break. Today I'm going to talk about the Here We Still Stand conference and an opportunity for those of you who either couldn't make it because of calendar restrictions, geographical restrictions, whatever it was, but still want to see the video from that. We are doing a live stream of not everything at the conference, but the main stage events and maybe one or two of the breakouts of the Here We Still Stand conference this October, October 19th through the 21st. And you can sign up for that with the link in the show notes. All you have to do, it's going to be completely free for this live stream, is you have to give us your name and your email address. When you do that, you'll get sent a code to, it's basically a link that'll go to your inbox to invite you to watch these events live. Like I said, not everything from the conference is going to be on there, but most of the main stage events are going to be live streamed, so you can watch those as they happen on the days they happen. this is actually turning out to be really popular. I think we already have over 1,000 people signed up for this, which is far more than what even our limits for attendance at the conference are in that physical space. So there's definitely a lot of people who have been interested in coming to the conference and aren't able to. If you haven't signed up for this already because you haven't seen the ad, we've posted various ads for this online, but if you haven't seen that and you listen to this show and you're not going to be able to make it, this is pretty much your chance to get a hold of those right away, and you can watch those videos that day. If you sign up for this also, you'll get the immediate notification when everything is available, video and audio that was recorded at that conference for download or watching online and the like, because we are recording podcasts at this conference. We're recording all of the breakout sessions, all of the main stage sessions, and those will be available in video or audio form online some time down the road. But those who sign up for the live stream will get access far before that.
Great idea.
Okay. So that about covers our break. So we have 10 more minutes to sum up this episode on doing what is in you. We've talked about the implications that this has on the law. We've talked about how this kind of distorts the gospel. What ends up being sort of Luther's alternative and the solution to this is the end of it.
It's not going to come until thesis 25 and 26.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. The very, very end of this. And I think it's probably worth it to go in this. And this is why I was saying at the beginning that he is refuting this at every level of the disputation. He mentions this directly about halfway through, I want to say 17 and 18. There's a reference to this, but...
Well, he acknowledges, if you just stick with 17, he acknowledges that up until then, he might be creating some despair in his reader.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You think? No.
He keeps telling them that they can't do this, you can't do that. You know, you're going to think this, that's wrong, da da da.
Yep. Yep.
And so 17, he says, well, I know this might give you cause for despair.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. One scholar divides the whole thing. One, the problem of good works, theses 1 through 12. Two, the problem of the will, 13 through 18. The Great Divide, the Way of Glory and the Way of the Cross, 19 through 24. Good works in us, the righteousness of faith, 25 to 28.
Yeah.
But the first two-thirds or more is what we might call the negative side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's Ferdy that you're talking about,
yeah,
there, right? And one of the things that Ferdy and sort of those people that he trained are really great at, too, is understanding that a really central point to understanding Luther is understanding his ideas on the will, because a lot of this has to do with that, right? Because you might, even if you're arguing over good works, you might still be that person that says, well, yeah, but no matter what I want to do, I usually pull it out in the end, and I still go to church on Sunday, and I don't beat my wife, and I pat my kids on the head at night before they go to bed, and I still do all these things that are decent things. And that's why Luther understood this, and people like Ferdy are good at explicating Luther on this, is that really you're going, and it's why he puts it in the middle, I think, in his way of making his argument, you're going to get hit in the face pretty soon with the fact that your will is the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, it doesn't take long to get there.
Yeah, the problem isn't necessarily what you pull off or don't pull off on the outside. Uh-huh. The problem is that on the inside, uh-huh, you know, that's what, there's a distortion there that sets you at odds with God.
It will always be towards self.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's always going to be towards self, and it's always going to set you at odds with God and his plan for your salvation.
Yep.
And that's why, you know, after he gets done with his section on the will, that's why he jumps right into this. Okay, so I've put you in a point of despair.
Yeah.
So let's get you out of that.
Yeah.
And then saying that the point of this isn't for you to despair, but the point of it is for you to be aroused and to desire to humble yourself. And so being humble to end up relying on Christ alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then to get what Rod was pointing to at the beginning here, Thesis 28, which closes the theological theses of the Heidelberg Disputation, goes, the love of God does not find but creates that which is lovable or pleasing to it, and the love of man is made up of those things which man loves. So there's a big distinction there, but God doesn't require us to climb to him. He creates us, recreates us.
It's climbing to him is the enemy.
Yep. Ferdy calls it the great recreation of the sinner into the believer.
I think got this from you, Rod, back in undergrad, but it reminds me of sort of the phrase that I had heard in LCMS circles quite a bit, that the gospel gives what the law demands.
Yes.
Right. And that's why law gospel theology is not just a hermeneutic. It's not just, you know, whatever. It's actually the way that the scriptures and our salvation work. The demands of the law are real.
Yep.
These are
and good.
And good. And they are real demands. So yep. If you ever believe that you do not have to fulfill the law, you're wrong.
Uh-huh.
You too, right? The requirements, the demands of the law are real things that are pressed upon you every single day. Yep. It's just also that the gospel is real and that the gospel gives you what that law demands. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, you know...
Great way to sum it up.
Yeah, Luther's saying that the love of God does not find but creates, which is pleasing to it. You know, the law presses on you, looking for its, you know, you to fulfill it, and it does not find its fulfillment in you. But God creates that fulfillment in Christ and is given to you by the proclamation of the gospel.
Yep. So. Nice close.
Great. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the show. It was great to have the regular cast and crew of the show back after a long summer. It's surprising how easily it is to just hop back into it. We are going to be back with another episode with all of us and hopefully some more again as summer is winding down. You can look out for some more special episodes because I'll be traveling to Norway where I'll get to interview John Pless again and Jim Ness again. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So we'll have interviews on that. And then Dr. Keith is doing some vocational interviews as well that will pop up on the show sometime down the road here also. So we'll catch you next time.